From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, God, Ghosts, and the Paranormal Ministry. And in a moment, Neil deGrasse Tyson joins us with his latest work, Letters from an Astrophysicist. Here's what's happening. In an unprecedented move, Pacific Gas and Electric has begun shutting off power to about 800,000 customers across Northern California, all in an attempt to avoid wildfires caused by winds damaging power equipment. The first power cutoffs, expected to affect 513,000 customers, began shortly after midnight in several counties around Sacramento, including Placer and Yuba, amid strengthening winds, and continued to roll out into the early morning hours as well. The blackouts will impact 34 counties in Central and Northern California, and it would be the biggest power shutdown so far as utilities across the state attempt to reduce wildfire risks due to heavy winds. Utilities malfunctions have been tied to some of the state's most destructive fires, including last year's Camp Fire, which devastated Paradise, California, and then the 2017 Wine Country blazes as well. Democratic presidential hopeful and contender Joe Biden has called for the impeachment of his potential 2020 election foe, President Donald Trump, for the first time as a partisan fight over a congressional investigation of the Republican president continues to deepen. Turkey, the country, has announced that its ground forces invaded northeastern Syria to fight against Kurdish forces just hours after launching an initial assault in the area, as the first reports of death have emerged as we have withdrawn American troops from that region. Dr. Jerome Corsi with us, and a noted author and researcher. Jerry, I want your take, first of all, on Joe Biden's comments about impeaching the president.
Well, I think the reality of the Ukrainian situation is that the Biden corruption, and going back to 2014, is really the serious issue within Ukraine, as well as Hillary Clinton. I mean, Hillary Clinton did get opposition research on Paul Manafort from Ukraine in 2016 during the election. It was actually false data that supposedly Paul Manafort, then the campaign chairman for Donald Trump, was getting cash payments from the former president of Ukraine, a guy named Yanukovych, who was a communist but also a freedom fighter for Ukraine and fled to Moscow. The cash payments turned out not to have been made, and Manafort was not indicted for any cash payments that he got from Yanukovych. He was indicted for other issues of not paying his income tax on money he earned in Ukraine and elsewhere. But the point is that the corruption in Ukraine is going to stem from the Democratic involvement. Hillary Clinton's use of information in 2016 from Ukraine to damage Donald Trump, and Biden family corruption on the money that went into Ukraine, which was more than $1 billion from the United States, much of which ended up in corruption.
And, of course, the Republicans who are upset with President Trump are more upset with him, not over the impeachment inquiry, but over pulling out troops from Syria.
Well, that issue has now developed over the last couple of days, last few days. And truthfully, all that the President Trump pulled out from northern Syria was about 50 troops. I mean, this is not a huge group that has been withdrawn.
Makes it sound like thousands, doesn't it?
It does, but it's, you know, like George, it's 50 troops that we relocated from northern Syria, 50, George, that's all. And the issue is that the Turks have, for going back to World War One, have dealt with this, the Kurds, who are a minority in Turkey, but the Kurdish minority stretches across Iraq and Iran, as well as Syria and Turkey. They've never had a country at the end of the Ottoman Empire after World War One that was going to be formed a Kurdistan, but it never happened. They have their own language, they have their own traditions, they're mostly Sunni Muslims, And I think President Trump has a point. To get into these conflicts in the Middle East require almost a graduate degree in the ethnic cultures within the Middle East.
Oh, my God, yeah. We're still in Iraq. We're still in Afghanistan. We're all over the place.
If we don't get out of these, I mean, what do we, you know, if you did a survey in the United States and asked people who the Kurds were and what's the history of Kurdistan and why are we going to send troops to die fighting for the Kurds, I don't think you'd find very many people who even know what you're talking about.
No, I don't think so either. But
and George, I think that Donald Trump also has a legitimate point. And I've always said that war is the problem in the Middle East. It's not the solution. And if we have these endless wars, we've been in Afghanistan for 12 years. There's still Taliban very active in Afghanistan. There's more heroin poppy being developed in Afghanistan now than ever. And we're not going to solve these century-old problems in the Middle East.
Actually, Afghanistan, we've been there 18 years, Jerry.
18 years. Well, I'll tell you, George, it's just astounding to me how we can easily get into these conflicts. You know, you can beat the drums and the neocons and everyone says, let's put troops in to save the Kurds. Well, we go in to save the Kurds in northern Syria. And 18 years later, we're going to still be there.
Yeah, we have no exit plan. Jerry, keep in touch with us with these breaking stories that are bound to be popping for the next week or so. Really appreciate it. Dr. Jerome Corsi, his website, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Spending time in the company of good friends regularly has been shown to have a positive impact on health. But for many Americans, socializing in adulthood gets harder with age. A recent survey reveals that 45% of the adults admit they find it hard to make new friends. In fact, the average adult hasn't made a new friend in the last 5 years, according to the survey. The United States is less competitive than it was a year ago, and the global economy remains hobbled by low productivity despite a decade of cheap money from central banks. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Michael Shedlock. Mish, what do you think about that one?
Hey, George, what do you think? I mean, I'm looking at this report here. It says that Singapore has now replaced the United States as the best place in the world to do business. George, I'm looking at these stats here. The Singapore GDP, $43 billion. U.S. GDP, $2.5 trillion, roughly. 56 times more than Singapore. So, just listening to that last report that was just on, you and I have problems. The average U.S. citizen has problems with, you know, what we're doing militarily around the world. But if we look at what this survey is based on, which is competitiveness, the U.S. has the most powerful economy in the world, almost 50,000 per capita GDP, we're comparing the U.S. to Singapore. George, where do you want to live? I think I want to live in the U.S., not Singapore.
I will. I'm not leaving this country at all.
George, right. That's it. And I go down this list. Singapore is number one, U.S. number two, Hong Kong is number three. Look at the strife in Hong Kong. Isn't Hong Kong a part of China? Yet we're still labeling it as number three, Switzerland five, Japan six, Germany seven. Let's go down the list here a little bit. Canada dropped to 14.
Jeez. Are you amazed that our economy stays strong during all this stuff that's going on in Washington right now?
George, our economy is strong despite what's going on because we have the largest, most freest capital markets in the entire world.
Yes, we do. Well said, Mish. Thank you so much. Mish's website as well, linked up to coasttocoastam.com. A limited edition sneaker, which is filled with holy water in the soles, blessed by a priest, sold out within minutes of its debut, despite each pair costing, get this, a whopping $3,000. Can you believe that? Brooklyn-based company released the shoe, which is a pair of Nike Air Max 97s that have been injected with holy water sourced from the Jordan River, and they sold for $3,000. Up next, one of our favorite guests, Neil deGrasse Tyson, with us. His book, Letters from an Astrophysicist. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest for the next couple hours, Neil deGrasse Tyson, back with us, born in New York City, the same week NASA was founded, by the way. His interest in the universe traces back to the age of 9 after a first visit to the Hayden Planetarium of the American Museum of Natural History. He was educated in the public schools of New York City, and through his graduation from the Bronx High School of Science and after an M.A. in physics from Harvard, he got a Ph.D. in astrophysics from Columbia and a postdoctoral research fellowship at Princeton. He has become the Frederick P. Rose Director of the Hayden Planetarium, where he visited when he was a youngster, and he has served there since 1996. His latest work is called Letters from an Astrophysicist. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been too long.
It has been way too long, and your successes have been astronomical.
I see what
into the saying. Cosmos. I love it. And a great book, I mean, including letters from people who really think the world of you, most of them, right?
Yeah, that's not in my mind when I'm answering, but I think the fact that they took that much effort to sit down, in some cases they're handwritten or typewritten, others they're emails, but in all cases they're bringing to me issues in their lives that they expect or hope that a perspective that I would bring, gleaned from a cosmic perspective, might help them make their next decision. So a lot of the letters are very personal, and much of the topics are topics I generally don't talk about publicly. So you've never seen me comment on Bigfoot.
No.
Really?
No.
You know, just not that I couldn't, I just don't. But people write in, and, you know, they're not writing to try to argue or to be angry, although there are a few angry letters in there. I collected those.
We all get those.
there's a chapter called Hate Mail, where I just put in some samples of people who were really angry for something I said or did or had on video. But generally, people are really curious what I think about their experience or their the challenges that they're facing. There's a chapter on death and dying. People just learn that they have terminal cancer. There's a chapter on parenting, people wondering what should they do next with their kid. And it's not that they think I'm some kind of psychologist. It's that there's usually some thread in the inquiry that involves science or science literacy or some conflict they have with science, particularly if they're orthodox religious. So there are letters in there from Christians, from there's a Muslim, Jews, there's even a Buddhist who'd written in. So I'm flattered, but it's an awesome responsibility to handle such inquiries. And these are what I've collected over the years, and none of them were responded to with any kind of cavalier way. I give everyone very serious attention to what they've asked.
I can tell just by reading your responses that you give them the dignity, and that's impressive. I got to ask you this. You've been going all around the country promoting this incredible book, Letters from the Astrophysicist. You've been on CBS This Morning, The View. You've been with Stephen Colbert.
You watching all those shows?
Yeah, I do. We get them. We go, and my staff does.
Yeah.
Last year, a couple allegations against you. My newsman in me has to ask you this, and then let's move on, because you were exonerated of all this stuff. But there were some harassment allegations against you. I tend to think the bigger you get in your industry, the more things will be popped up or created. Anyways, you got in the middle of that. You've been exonerated. You learned something from all of this, though, didn't you?
Well, I mean, just first of all, that I came to value friendship and family and fans who supported me throughout the entire time. And you know, sometimes you can take that for granted. You say, oh, they're there. But then when they're really there, I came to, it helped me. It was a very long year. And especially once the investigations were released and the press releases came out, it enabled me to sort of get back to work in a focused way.
Good.
The universe beckons, and so does the curiosity of the public, which is I'm a servant of their curiosity. That's honestly how I think about my work. And so,
Well, yeah. you knew you were going to get exonerated, but did it bother you or affect you while this was going on? I mean, how do you function when stuff like that is
up? Yeah, it's a great question. I think due process has to run its course, and often people can be impatient with it or want to draw their own conclusions on partial information or no information, you know, especially in modern times. But due process is something that is a fundamental part of civilization, right? And so sometimes it concerns me when people don't care about due process, or if they they want to circumvent it and just come up with their own views and that's it, right? Or we live in an era where that's kind of common, right? Especially in social media, everybody's got a strong opinion about everything, no matter how much information they carry into it. So that's a little bit of the climate in which we live. I'm just thankful for due process.
Well, and I'm glad you got it behind you, and you continue to move on, and your successes have been fantastic. The radio and TV show Star Talk seems to be doing well for you, too.
Yeah, that's our, if you allow me a minute just to sort of boast on that.
You're on with me for 2 hours. You got all the time you want.
You got time for this. That show began with a grant from the National Science Foundation, because we wanted to bring science to the public in a way that didn't require, you know, begging for money every quarter, like in an NPR model.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
We all know and love Science Friday, but they're begging for money every 3 months or 6 months. And I just thought, if we combined it with some fun sort of comedic levity, focused on celebrities as guests, and I'm the host, rather than a journalist interviewing a scientist, it's a scientist interviewing interviewing celebrities. And the magic of this is that no matter what the celebrity does for a living, there's science operating in their lives. And then the conversation explores where and what that science is and how it has affected their livelihood. And for many people, you would never guess, many of them have like a soft geek underbelly where in other settings, they're not rewarded for showing that geekitude, but on Star Talk, we celebrate it. And so it's just fun. For example, David Crosby, we had him as a guest. You know, he's Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Sure.
Did you know he read science fiction before he ever composed his first song, and was a huge science fiction fan, because it enabled him to think about a future, and he dreamed about space and a better world. And so this gets revealed, right? But if he was on a music show, that would never come out. So this show actually was able to sustain itself, and we were nominated 4 times for an Emmy, and we won the Webby Award for our
fantastic
web work. So we're all very proud of the product, and it's really just an effort to bring the universe down to earth.
After we lost Carl Sagan, you kind of stepped up and basically, I'm not going to say replaced him because he was Carl Sagan, but you fulfilled a void.
That's a great sentence.
Exactly. But you fulfilled a void when he passed on.
Yeah, I think especially because I was asked by his widow, who was a huge talent unto herself, who was co-writer of the original Cosmos and of the Cosmos I hosted and of the next Cosmos. She approached me, saw my rise in visibility, and asked if I was interested in hosting. I try not to do things that other people can do. I'd rather do things that I can do uniquely.
Mm-hmm.
I thought there's at least a half dozen people here who could host Cosmos. I don't need to do this. But then I thought about it, and I said, well, I knew Carl Sagan. But when he was, like, you know, fully formed, and I was a student, and those encounters had some influence on me. And so maybe if I were host, I'd be able to communicate that, if not explicitly, but certainly sort of emotionally in my delivery, as being handed the torch of a hugely influential and successful series. What's interesting about Cosmos is you're not even thinking it's a documentary, right?
Right.
When you say, let's watch a documentary, that comes with certain expectations and assumptions. Cosmos is something else. it operates on you differently, emotionally as well as intellectually.
And it's fun and entertaining to watch. Stay with us, Neil. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back with Neil deGrasse Tyson. His book is called Letters from an Astrophysicist. Next hour, you get to join in and ask a question or two as well. And we'll be back in a moment with Neil deGrasse Tyson as we talk about his work, Letters from an Astrophysicist. If you're a Coast Insider, of course, we are adding two more programs to the Art Bell Vault, and Tommy has them.
Yes. Every week they are added. This is a new feature, of course. It's called the Art Bell Vault. It's a collection of classic Art Bell programs. One of the new ones I'm really excited about is Witches and Black Magic with Dr. Evelyn Paglini. I really miss her. She was a pretty good guest here. These are classic audio shows you really don't want to miss. They're all heard without interruption. So it's a great time to be an insider. If you're not, just go to the coasttocoastam.com website. All the details are right there.
Super. Thanks, Tom. George Norrie back with you, along with Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil, as an astrophysicist, what subject really gets to you talking about the cosmos that really just lights your fire?
Well, I like probing our ignorance. So, and in astrophysics, we encounter profound areas of ignorance with regard to dark matter. We call it dark matter, but it's really dark gravity. It's 85% of the gravity of the universe is of unknown origin, and it's the longest unsolved mystery in modern astrophysics. Has been around since we've known that we don't know what it is, since the 1930s. And more recently, in the last two decades, the discovery of dark energy, what we call dark energy, and it's some mysterious pressure in the universe forcing us to accelerate in our expansion against the wishes, the collective wishes of the gravity of everything within it. That's a mystery, and you add those two sort of forces operating on the universe together, and it's like 95% of what is driving the universe, and the remaining 5%, that's what we understand, and that gives us our chemistry and our biology and our geology and the astrophysics and all of our engineering. All of that is contained within the 5% that we understand, and what we understand very well. But the rest of this, that is just so that excites me. And what was around before the Big Bang, that excites me because we don't know. And one last one, borrowing from another discipline, how did we go from organic molecules to self-replicating life?
That's right.
That's and all of these are scientific frontiers. And when you're a scientist, you have to learn to love the questions themselves. If you require that everything has an answer, you're not going to ever. What you really do is you fear the frontier, and a scientist has to embrace it.
With the 95% that we don't understand, why is it so large? Why is that number so high?
I'm sorry, we're working hard here.
I want answers.
It turns out to be that large. I mean, we didn't, you know, until dark energy was discovered, we didn't know. There were some other things we didn't quite understand what was going on, and this thing that we call dark energy actually explains other phenomena that previously were mysterious in our research. So, what's interesting thing about discovering moving out in a frontier, when you make discoveries, they can inform other things that maybe you thought you knew but didn't really know. They said, oh, wow, that applies here. We didn't know that. This happened with Albert Einstein when he, in 1916, advanced the general theory of relativity, which showed the curvature of space and time, really freaky stuff. You know what just fell out of that? The fact that Mercury had an orbit around the sun that didn't obey Newton's laws. And we all kind of, we weren't so perturbed by that. We said, maybe there's a very hard to detect planet orbiting closer to the sun than Mercury is, who's producing extra gravity that we're not accounting for. So in fact, there was a hypothetical planet called Vulcan, and we said, and the reason why no one found it is because it's orbiting really close to the sun and it's lost in its glare all the time. So people would look for it during eclipses because you blot out the sun,
sure.
You'll see it, And when Einstein came out with general relativity, you apply that equation to Mercury, bada bing, it explained it for free. And so we dropped Vulcan practically overnight in the presence of this description. So here you solve one other problem, you solve some other problem, and it solves a different problem that you've been working on. And that's the fun part of science.
The late astronomer Fred Hoyle did not accept the Big Bang Theory as it was presented in the days and as it was still presented. He passed away in 2001. I tend to agree with him.
Well, first of all, he didn't accept it, yet he named it. Just
yeah. He didn't know what he was naming, I guess.
He named it kind of in a pejorative, joking sort of way, and it just stuck. So, yeah, Fred Hoyle was a brilliant man, and he is a co-author on, I think, one of the top five, if not the top three, significant research papers there ever was. It's a paper that the four authors are Burbidge, that was a married couple, Fowler and Hoyle, and this paper came out in 1957. A research paper, and it was, I forgot the exact title, but it was on the origin of the chemical elements. And it was the first time all the calculations were done with the benefit of some declassified papers from the Second World War, nuclear papers from the Second World War, where they can calculate how you can grow large atoms from small atoms in the heat of the centers of stars, which then explode via supernova, scatter these heavy elements across the galaxy, enabling things to form other than stars, like planets, and on such planets with organic molecules, life. So that, as a description of the origin of the elements, for me, is the greatest gift of 20th century astrophysics to civilization. He's a co-author on that paper. So no one denies him his brilliance or his innovative thinking. He just bet on the wrong horse at the end of the day.
Exactly. And when they talk about how he rejected the Big Bang Theory, what does that mean?
Oh, well, at the time, there was no data. See, people, there's something about science that I don't think is widely appreciated. When scientists argue, this is the state of the argument. It's, let's say you and I are arguing at a scientific conference. We both know, walking up to each other, ready to go into fisticuffs, we both know that either I'm right and you're wrong, or you're right and I'm wrong, or we're both
wrong.
Correct. But we both can't be right if we're saying two different things. And so we can argue, but what comes out of it when the discussion is fertile, is scientifically and intellectually honest and fertile, what comes out of it is, maybe if we got this new set of data, that will help resolve this difference. So these conversations, as long as some observers are listening and experimentalists, they'll say, hey, I can test for that, and I can distinguish between your two ideas. And so we go out and have a beer, we stop the argument, we wait for the new data to come, and then it either supports one person's or the other, or neither of our ideas, and you have to be ready to discard it. And at the time, Hoyle was loudest about the anti-Big Bang Theory. We didn't have there was no data yet.
Mm-hmm.
And when we discovered the cosmic microwave background, which is a prediction of the Big Bang, that was really hard for him to explain with his idea of the universe, which was called a steady state universe, where the universe always was and always will be. And even though it was expanding, because that was an observation made by Hubble, the man, back in the 1920s, what he said was, if it always kind of looks the same, that means it won't look the same if you're expanding. You become more and more diluted. So he hypothesized that hydrogen atoms would just sort of pop in out of thin air or thin space at a rate that was enough to create new galaxies in the voids left by the expansion. So that no matter when you looked at the universe and no matter where you looked at the universe, it would look statistically about the same. And then people said to him, Fred, you're just popping particles out of nothing? That's absurd. And he said, is it any more absurd than you saying the whole universe started in one explosion? You know, so that was touche, right?
Perfect.
I mean, again, he's
exactly.
A brilliant guy. So, and then as more and more evidence accumulated, you could no longer hold on to a steady state universe. And he would ultimately die. I don't know if he took his steady state with him to his grave. You know, you can get kind of crotchety when you're older and sort of set in your ways. There's a famous quote, I think, from Max Planck, one of the fathers of quantum physics, where he said, new ideas are never, they don't really win over the old guard. The old guard just grows old and dies, and the new guard rises up, and they've known it all along.
Exactly. No, he's right. He's right. Now, is it conceivable that this universe was not conceived from the Big Bang, and Hoyle is right? Was it always here?
The evidence, I'm just saying the evidence doesn't support it. All evidence shows that we came out of an explosion 14 billion years ago. And now, I can tell you this.
But what the heck exploded?
Well, that's the frontier. See, you're getting all impatient.
I am.
On answers. And I'm
taking a swing at you already at this conference we were at.
So I'm just saying it's a frontier. Now, we have some indications, theoretical indications from quantum physics, that we may be part of a multiverse. And if we're part of a multiverse, then we're just one bubble that's growing among possibly infinite number of bubbles. And so our beginning is not really special in any singular sense. It's part of some continuum that's a continual process that has always been happening and will continue to happen. But we're motivated by the predictions of quantum physics, not by any actual observation of an actual parallel universe. And that reminds me, one of the questions in the letters book is a woman who said, she's a stagehand for plays, and she was walking on one side of the stage, and she saw someone on the other side of the stage that looked just like her and was dressed like her and paused, and they sort of regarded each other at the same moment, and except this other person was male and she's female. And so she asked, could there have been some overlap of a parallel universe where she's sort of in that universe but is slightly different?
Yep.
That she's male. And so we had a conversation about, you know, the likelihood of parallel universes overlapping. So it's just interesting the kinds of questions people have where they wonder if there's a cosmic interpretation of what it is they encountered.
Is it conceivable, Neil, we will never, ever get the answer about this?
No, I don't think so. For example, there are reasons why what I'm about to tell you is unlikely, but it's the kind of way you need to think to give you some hope as you go forward. So it turns out that while light is trapped within a universe that contains you, the force of gravity is not. The force of gravity can spill out of your universe and be felt by other universes. So you can pose the question, is what we're calling dark matter, is it regular matter in a nearby universe whose gravitational field is spilling out and we feel it in our universe and it's like, whoa, it's here, it's somewhere here, let's look for it, but really you're not going to find it anywhere because it's coming from another place. So in this way, you would be testing the existence of another universe without actually having to visit it. And you got to be careful visiting these other universes because at least theoretically, they could have slightly different laws of physics. And that will not bode well for you if the charge on the electron is slightly different and you cross over in tunnel into that other universe, you could collapse into a pile of goo because none of your molecular forces hold you together anymore. So you got to watch out for that.
Why did you get a hate letter about Pluto? What did you do?
Now you want to start another fight? Now, see, this is. So no, I was an accessory to the demotion of Pluto, but that being said, I was probably the earliest visible exponent of rethinking Pluto's status. And so therefore I got sort of dragged in as like the person to blame. But I can give you the list of other people you can go complain to.
Now, is it today? Is it a planet or a planetoid?
It's a dwarf planet.
It's been
a dwarf planet by classification since officially since 2006. But in the year 2000, 6 years before that official vote, here in New York City, where I serve as director of the Hayden Planetarium, as you duly announced in the intro, we were renovating the facility significantly and redoing all the exhibits, and we saw that that Pluto was not faring well in the planethood status, and we thought we want to future-proof the exhibits. What should we do? So what we did was, where we represented the planets, we removed Pluto and grouped it with other icy bodies in the outer solar system, called the Kuiper Belt.
It drove the astrologers crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Not astronomers, but astrologers.
Yeah, the astrologers, yeah. So some were angry, but others dealt with it, right? They tried to fold it into their new charts. And on the other side of that, in my previous book, which was actually about war, a thick volume. If you're in a hurry, don't buy it. But if you're into sort of history and the role of astrophysics and astronomy in general in navigation and hegemony and dominance and war, this book, it's called Accessory to War, The Unspoken Alliance Between Astrophysics and the Military. In there, we talk about what happened when Pluto was discovered in 1930. That sent a wave through the astrological world, people rapidly trying to include it and then trying to analyze world leaders and things because maybe they had missed something for previously only in having invoked eight planets. And Hitler, which is we talk about a bit in the book, was deep into the occult. And this was basically accurately captured in Raiders of the Lost Ark, which was pre-Second World War, mid-1930s. But you see him you see Hitler's people trying to gain control of the Ark because it has the spiritual powers.
Hold on, Neil. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back. We'll talk more about your work, Letters from an Astrophysicist, and we'll take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.